Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, July 3rd, 2019. Officials in Western Lake State arrest a journalist working for a Catholic radio station.
Well, if he was arrested by national security, then it is not a different issue altogether. It is not that of the governor. Then the national security should be responsible for his arrest.
And South Sudan health officials are on high alert as a confirmed Ebola case is reported closer to the South Sudan DRC border.
We are more worried because it's coming nearer. People are moving. A contact can cross to South Sudan and then it can evolve disease. So we are worried. And so the only thing we can do is to enhance our surveillance and screening.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Catholic Radio Network is calling on authorities in Western Lake State to release the director of Good News Radio. Mariel Deng was arrested and accused of interviewing the former governor of Lake State. Mary Ajit, director of Catholic Radio Network, says Western Lake State's officials should address their complaints to the media authority in Juba. She condemned a decision by the Western Lake State authorities to screen all radio programs airing on the Catholic radio station in Rumbek before going on air. Majak Isaac Rohr is the Western Lake State Information Minister. He denies having any information about Mariel Deng's arrest.
We don't have that journalist. We have Mariel Abdelgader Manouk. That is the one that we have. There are so many media houses.
They say he's a director of the Catholic radio station, their news director.
And this is what I'm telling you. Mariel is working in a business media house from the Catholic Diocese of Rumbek. So they are not direct to the government administration. So if he was arrested, I'm not aware of it, why he was arrested and where was he arrested and who arrested him.
I mean, but this is coming from your state and it's an issue of press freedom. Do you agree with me on that?
You know, if it is the government that has differed with him and it is the government that has arrested him, he would have already prevailed the why the reason he was arrested. But otherwise, he might have committed his own crime somewhere else apart from the government. So that might be the social issue, which is not of the concern of the government. It would have been revealed to the government, if it is the government that is responsible for it.
He was picked by national security because he interviewed the former governor, John Mamer Deng.
Well, I'm not denying actually what was happening. Because I'm lacking information about that. If I was informed, I would have already explained to you that why he was arrested. As it is you who is actually having more knowledge about why he was arrested, as you provided. So let me make some inquiry first of all to know who was arresting him, who arrested him, and when and why. So the interview that he had conducted with the former governor, it was as a private issue. So I don't know if his government, the former governor, has no authority to come and arrest the people. Unless you complain, maybe if he has a complaint, that will be a police case between him and the one who arrested him.
The journalist interviewed the former governor to balance a story. There was an allegation that the former governor embezzled some money. And so he went to interview the former governor to get his side of the story. And that interview angered authorities in Western Lake State.
But the former governor actually is being protected by the current government, because I don't think they have valid link. That one is a private issue between the former governor and the one who has opened the case against him. Why should the government interfere to go and arrest somebody who has interviewed him? The offender might have a link with that case, and that's why he opened the case to be arrested.
They said the state authorities, Western Lake State authorities, were not happy that Marial went and interviewed the former governor. That's the story we are getting.
But that former governor is now under the control of the current government. Is he being protected by the current government? That means the government is actually one of the people who are with it. So that thing, I think it is very far from the government. This is a private. He has not even bothered the money from government. But he has been bothered. The government will be responsible for him to arrest it. Anybody.
There must be orders from somewhere. He was arrested by the national security in Rumbek.
Well, if he was arrested by national security, then it is not that, might be a different issue altogether. It is not that of the governor. Then the national security should be responsible for his arrest to explain why he arrested him.
That's Majak Isaac Rohr, the Minister for Information in Western Lake State. He was speaking with me from Rumbek earlier today. We just got some information from Rumbek that Marial Deng has been released. He was released at 6:30 South Sudan local time. South Sudan's health ministry is reinforcing measures to prevent the spread of Ebola following confirmation of one case in the Democratic Republic of Congo, 70 kilometers or about 40 miles from the South Sudan DRC border. The government says it has dispatched a team to the border area. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
Dr. Pinyi Nyimol, South Sudan Director General for Disease Control and Emergency Response Services, says this confirmed case indicates that the deadly Ebola virus is moving closer to the border of South Sudan.
We are more worried because it's coming nearer, because people are moving, okay? So anybody, a contact can cross to South Sudan and then it can develop disease. So we are worried. And so the only thing we can do is to enhance our surveillance and screening, and also to alert our healthcare workers about this, anybody coming. Especially, they have to start with traveling history. They have to ask whether this person have been in DRC or not. If from DRC now, they have to take more precaution in handling the case.
Nimol says the case was registered yesterday in the area of Arewara, which is a trading center located northeast of Ituri province, about 43 miles from the border of Ye River State. Arewara is closer to the border with Uganda than it is to the border with South Sudan. The 40-year-old woman traveled some 500 kilometers from the area of Beni, north of Kivu province in the DRC, according to Congo officials. Nyimol says it is the first ever confirmed case somewhat close to South Sudan DRC border since the outbreak in DR Congo's Kivu province, some 500 kilometers from South Sudan's border last August.
Upon receiving that information that there is a confirmed case in Arewara, at the border of South Sudan, the Ministers of Health, in collaboration with the WHO, have sent today, they are going to send 7 personnel to the Ye River State. And the aim of this is to go and strengthen surveillance and preparedness for Ebola.
To clarify, Arewara is not on the South Sudan border. Nyimol says for the last 6 months, South Sudan has been under high alert and increased its surveillance response at several border screening centers established between the DRC and Uganda.
We have points of entry doing screening at the high-risk states. We have Ebola treatment unit established, like in Jubaya. We have one here near the lab, and there is an ambulance ready for any case, and there are 20 staff. If there is a suspect at Juba International Hotspot, it can be collected to the center and then specimen taken for investigation. The same with Numuli and other points of entry.
South Sudan's Ye River State border with DR Congo has seen a significant number of people crossing the border on a daily basis. Ebola virus is a deadly disease that affects humans and non-human primates. Symptoms of Ebola include unexplained hemorrhage bleeding, high fever, severe headache, muscle pain, weakness, and vomiting. It is spread through body fluids and the blood of an infected person. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
A new UN mission in South Sudan report accuses government and opposition forces of deliberately targeting civilians during a surge in conflict in the former Central Equatorial State between September 2018 and April 2019, right after the revitalized peace deal was signed. The report says more than 100 civilians were killed and about 100 women and girls were raped or sexually assaulted. As Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba, both sides deny their forces were involved in any rights violations.
In a recorded audio message sent to South Sudan in Focus, Eugene Ninederera, head of the Human Rights Division at ANMIS, says the violence led to the displacement of more than 56,000 civilians within South Sudan and nearly 20,000 others who crossed into neighboring Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
We were able to document 95 incidents, including 30 attacks on villages. And we know that, according to us, there is at least 104 civilians who were killed and 35 others who were injured. And this is really related to the incidents that we have monitored during that period. There were also a number of other civilians, 187, who were abducted. For purposes as such as forced recruitment, forced labor, or sexual slavery.
Ninederera acknowledges the number of rights violations and abuses across the country has fallen since the signing of last year's peace deal, but he says Central Equatoria, especially Yei, has been an exception to the rule. But he says SPLA-IO and governments carried out attacks against civilians and armed rebel groups who didn't sign the deal, groups like the National Salvation Front and the South Sudan National Movement for Change are still attacking civilians. Ninederera says the violence took place in two distinct phases, including the SPLA-IO, NAS and SSMC when the groups clashed over territorial control in parts of the former state. He says during the first phase, the groups were responsible for killing at least 61 civilians who were either deliberately targeted or victims of indiscriminate gunfire, and at least 150 civilians were held in captivity by the groups, including women and girls taken as wives by commanders or raped by various fighters. Ninederera says the second phase of violence began in January when the government launched a military campaign to clear out what it called rebels from Central Equatorial region.
Government forces step up operation in the area around Yei, and these operations primarily targeted areas where civilians were perceived to be providing support to NAS and affiliated groups, and that's how they were targeted. And our investigation found that government forces appear to have engaged in a deliberate effort to displace civilians through attacks against on villages, which they achieved in part through the looting and destruction also of private property.
Ninederera says the government forces carried out coordinated campaigns to displace civilians from the areas. Lul Rai Kwang, spokesman for the South Sudan People's Defense Force, denies the accusation.
The report is before me. I can't read, and I would like to say that the report is vague. It's full of generalities. It lacks the specifics needed for the army to launch any meaningful investigation.
Lampo Gabriel, spokesperson for the SPLA-IO, admits that there were clashes in Yei River State after the signing of the September peace agreement, but says SPLA-IO forces fought against the NAS and SSMC in defense of their territory.
What happened in Yei River, specifically, I can say, around Mukaya, Minyori, and western side of Yei, we have been subjected to defend ourselves from these forces of Thomas Rilo and also Abraham Wani. They were targeting mostly families of the SPLA-IO soldiers.
Ninederera says ANMIS deployed an additional 150 troops to intensify patrols within Yei town and to outlining communities to deter violence and enable the safe delivery of humanitarian aid. He says ANMIS Chief David Scherer visited the area several times to engage with political and military leaders about the human rights abuses raised in the report, the impact of displacement, and the need for reconciliation and peace. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudan authorities look into reports of police harassment in Juba Town. We'll bring you that report right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how can you help young people discover their talents and develop them?
I think that can be done like from an early stage. Most of us right now are suffering and struggling with things because our parents didn't take the chance of getting to know our talents when we were very young. Because if a kid is young, you can easily tell what he or she is interested in.
I encourage you on how to develop your talent. If there is a need for money, and if I have, obviously I can give you.
What I can do is to inspire that young person to continue with that talent. And to develop them is to make sure that I continue working with that person.
Well, to me, I cannot help them in discovering, but whoever discovers himself, I can help in developing. And he has the will to develop.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. Some residents of Juba Town say security personnel who patrol the city at night are harassing civilians. One resident says she and her husband were thrown into the boot of their car after security personnel tried to rape her. Winnie Chirino has the story for VOA from Juba.
A 25-year-old woman, whom we'll call Achom, who is afraid of retribution from security agents, says she and her husband were returning from having dinner out when security operatives stopped them at High Cinema near the MTN building. She says five men in military uniform pretended to check for arms in their car, but soon began beating her husband for no reason, then carried him to the boot of their car. Achom says one agent climbed into the driver's seat, three were in the back, and the other squeezed himself next to her in the front seat and drove around.
They were threatening us that they would kill us. So I was still at the driver's seat since they did not move me since they started the hijacking. So when I was when we were about to go somewhere, they insisted that I should alight and go behind. And before that, they were all over touching me, trying to kiss me from behind, and those in front with me. It was awkward. So in the process, when I was going down, they were trying to rape me. They tore my clothes.
Achom says the armed men later carried her and put her in the boot of the car with her husband. She says the men drove them around until 3 a.m. when the car ran out of fuel. She says she and her husband realized after some time that the car was parked, and she finally peeped out and saw a security guard next to a billboard along Airport Road who she called to rescue them. Achom says the men took their car key and money from her husband. She says she and her husband reported the incident to police, but no one was arrested. Achom says police later told her and her husband a soldier escaped from custody. 39-year-old Atema Koi says he was returning from a party recently in Juba's Jebel suburb and dropped off some friends in the High Cinema suburb. He says on his way back, security operatives stopped him at a gunpoint in a place where there are usually no security checks. Koi says he stopped and turned on the interior light for the men to check the inside of the car, but they pushed him and his friend to the boot.
On the way back now through the High Cinema and MTN area, that's when they came out. There were two guys dressed in uniform, military uniform, known to South Sudan government, and then the other two were on civilian. Actually, not two. One was on civilian. Yeah. So that's where they picked us up with a few slaps here and there. All the way, they threw us to the boot, and they were the ones driving the car.
Akoi says the security agents drove him and his friend around in the car for nearly the entire night, dropping off and picking up other security operatives. He says he and his friend were left abandoned in the car around 4 a.m. in Atlabara, and later realized the security operatives took money from the car. Akoi says he too reported the case to the police, who wrote down notes and promised to call him to update him on any leads. He says since May, the police have done nothing. Major General Daniel Justin, spokesperson for the South Sudan National Police Service, says he's aware of security personnel harassing drivers at night and says police are doing their best to ensure the law is obeyed.
Whenever you have an incident, you have to file a case with the police because we will investigate and we will locate if at all it is a member of our night patrol. You give us the time, we will know who was there, at what time, and so on. So reporting is very important.
But Justin could not explain why security agents suspected of harassing citizens have not been arrested. Lulurai Kwang, spokesperson for South Sudan People's Defense Force, says he hasn't heard of incidences involving soldiers hijacking cars, but says he will inform top administration officials about the complaints.
I will bring this to the attention of SATCAS commanders and the relevant departments. I'll bring it to their attention so that some intelligence is carried out on those who are doing night patrols, so that we have a better picture of this kind of incidences.
Lul says soldiers are mainly deployed at roundabouts near the Dr. John Garang Mausoleum, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and Juba University. He advises drivers to report any harassment or car hijacking incident to the nearest police station or any military post, and those on duty should be able to identify the suspected officer. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sirino in Juba.
Still on police matters, police in Kenya have often been accused of using excessive force while in the line of duty. A new report published by Human Rights Watch states that police were involved in the killing of at least 21 people since August 2018 in two Kenya's slum settlements. Rahel Ombul reports for VOA from Nairobi.
On the evening of April 28, 2017, Isaac Kamau Mwangi left his mother's house in Nairobi's Kayole Estate to pick up his car at a car wash. His sister Ruth Mumbi says those were his final hours. A motorcycle driver told the family what happened to him.
He was on his knees pleading with people who wanted to kill him. And the only thing that the boda driver had was the shot and my brother screaming loud, calling out my name. I came to know the following day that he was killed by officers.
Colleagues remembered Kamau as a devoted taxi driver, his family as a loving father of two. To police, however, he was a wanted highway robber. Kamau's death is one of hundreds of cases of extrajudicial police killings documented by rights groups in Kenya. In its new report, Human Rights Watch accuses police of killing at least 21 suspects since August 2018 in Dandora and Mathare, two of Nairobi's slums. Human Rights Watch researcher Otieno Namwaya says the killings bore similarities.
The common trend was that either the police brand somebody a thief and then either warn the person or put their name on social media. And then a week or two later, the person is found dead or they ambush the person somewhere, either in the house or in the street, arrest the person or ask the person to kneel down and then shoot the person in broad daylight, sometimes in the full glare of the public.
The report says the Independent Policing Oversight Authority, IPOA, Kenya's police accountability institution, has not done enough to stop police from killing people. Since inception of the oversight body in 2011, there have only been 6 convictions of police officers accused of extrajudicial killings. Anne Makori, the IPOA chairperson, says the organization has investigated more than 5,500 cases and sent more than 1,900 others to the Public Prosecutor's Office, the ODPP.
Because we have investigative powers, where we find the officer is culpable, we forward that file to ODPP with a recommendation for prosecution because we don't have prosecutorial powers. As we speak, we have 164 files within ODPP and we have 49 files within the court system.
Mumbi says that in most cases, families like hers never find justice as witnesses are usually afraid to come forward.
For this case, the person who came to report to us, who saw what Kamau had gone through, was also afraid. In fact, he even changed his number and he doesn't even live in Nairobi.
In the Human Rights Watch report, Kenya's police spokesman is quoted as saying, any officer who breaches the law must face the consequences as an individual. He said the Independent Policing Oversight Authority ought to investigate the killings in Dandora and Mathare and ensure the culprits are prosecuted. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we move to Khartoum, where for several weeks, social media users have turned their profile pictures to a solid blue to show their support for protests in Sudan. As Ayan Dengbio reports from Washington, the social media campaign began with the death of a young protester.
26-year-old Mohamed Matar's favorite color was reportedly blue. The Sudanese-British engineer lost his life during the June 3rd crackdown, which left dozens killed. Sudanese-American Abdel Gadir al-Madani says Matar's death and the death of other protesters was felt around the world.
What happened that day, it's not just a tragedy to Sudan, it's to all humanity, because people were sleeping in their tent. Himself, he's one of those people, he does not need to be there. He's not struggling financially. He went to school in England, so he's from a well-off family. For him to be out there, he was actually a goal. And before he died, he just celebrated his birthday also. And also before he died, he had a message. He said, if we walk back from what's happening today, we betrayed all those people who lost their life. And that kind of message struck a chord in all Sudanese and gave them a wake-up call that if we walk away today, we literally betray all those people who lost their life. And I think that's why people kind of paid attention to his message.
According to media reports, Matar lost his life while trying to protect other protesters from gunshots. The hashtag Blue for Sudan has gained traction in the last few weeks as celebrities like Barbados artist Rihanna and social media influencers continue to show their support on their platforms. But the social media campaign has mainly caught on outside Sudan, according to Sudanese-American Miaz Abdelaziz.
Actually, people in Sudan don't even have internet access to the internet right now. So this was caught on
outside of Sudan.
Yes, people in Sudan probably are not even aware of this blue campaign or not like that because a lot of the people don't have access to the internet as we speak.
Sudanese-American Mohamed Mukhtar says he hopes Sudan's government allies like Saudi Arabia and Yemen get the message.
Because they are supporting military council. They don't want to because everybody knows that we have, you know, their military council and al-Bashir, the old regime, they sent troops in Saudi Arabia to support Saudi Arabia and a coalition. And this, we don't need that. They send the troops in Yemen. Why we are in Yemen? This is wrong. That's why we need to get out from Arab League and we don't want to be a tool in their toolbox so they can use us. No. We have a saying now. We have to understand to our rights, to have to understand to our people, and because of them even.
Internet in Sudan has been disrupted in recent months. Sites like Twitter and applications like WhatsApp have had inconsistent reliability. Despite the interruptions, Sudanese protesters have been able to organize mass demonstrations, while the Sudanese diaspora has been able to use online mediums to help their families back home reach a wider audience. Ayan Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We'll now leave you with the song Achanika Kimia by Diamond. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening this evening. We hope you can join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Najaribu kunyamaza ili moyo utaki unanambia tisimba japunguru mauiseme haki. Oh, najaribu kunyamaza acha laiza tagio anasema wala umena kidogo na mashabiki dangote wananambia mbona usemi chochote. Si uko na usiku zote ama ulezi nafanya uogope. Na media pande zote wanalalama kiongozi atoke. Nchi naingia matope, niende wapi na mi mtoto wote. Yani lawama nisionge kimya, ninyamaze mimi nisiseme kimya, mama kanambia nifunge mudomo kimya, nipato mudoko sana kimya, nisiseme kimya.
mengi majaribu, najitahidi epuka yasije nikose. Japo mengine swadakta, mengine hayana maana. Rafiki kipenzi wa karibu, hata nyimbo yake sikuweza iposti.